Mohawk Street is a busy thoroughfare that connects Whitesboro and Marcy, middle-class suburbs of Utica in upstate New York. Not far from where the road crosses the sluggish Mohawk River, down in the underbrush, just off the road, right there, is the spot where 16-year-old Kim Simon's battered and partially naked body was found on September 19th, 1985. In 1989, Steve Barnes, a fellow Marcy resident and former classmate of Kim's at Whitesboro Senior High, was convicted of her rape and murder and sentenced to 25 years to life in state prison. The problem was, he didn't do it.
Called a liar, murderous, rapist.
They didn't even have anything to really arrest him, let alone convict him.
People I thought were my friends, they weren't my friends.
It was just unbelievable to me that this man was convicted.
There always has been kind of a feeling on the part of too many jurors that he must be guilty, otherwise he wouldn't be there.
I had to fight for my whole life for 20 years to prove my innocence.
We got to it as a family. We never quit trying, we never quit praying, we never ever gave up hope, ever.
It can happen to anybody. It would happen to me.
We're all incarcerated.
The verdicts read as follows.
The most conservative sources seem to indicate that about 1% of all prisoners actually were wrongfully convicted.
Guilty of the crime of murder in the first degree.
Larry Golden is an attorney in Utica, New York, and a member of the New York State Bar Association's Task Force on Wrongful Convictions.
Probably the more realistic figures are in the 3 to 5% range if you look at a variety of sources.
With America's prison population at more than 2 million inmates, that means as many as 100,000 prisoners today may be incarcerated for crimes they did not commit. As Steve Barnes says, it can happen to anybody. But how did it happen to him? To understand that, it might help to understand the place where Steve Barnes and Kim Simon grew up. Marcy is a large, predominantly rural town, dotted with clusters of residential subdivisions. In 1985, fewer people lived in Marcy than do today. But even then, it was a fairly typical American town, a place of backyard barbecues and little league games.
We have a saying that we got on the bus in first grade and never looked back.
Ed Lewandrowski is Steve's longtime friend.
And that's when we met at St. Paul's School in Whitesboro, first grade.
Steve's mom, Sylvia Bouchard.
Actually, Steve was a little bit on the shy side. He was very fun-loving and, always good in sports. He played football. He was an altar boy. They went through Catholic school, always willing to help around the house. Just a typical all-American kid.
He's a great guy. He'd do anything for anybody. Always hardworking. Always very friendly. Really has a big heart.
We used to go out for hours and hours riding the snowmobile. We had this one dog that would follow us literally for hours, no matter where we went, miles and miles and miles. I'm Lisa Barnes Pulowski, and I am Steve Barnes' sister. Summertime, we went up to the Marcy Pool, swimming lessons in the morning, freezing cold weather, and then ride our bikes back in the afternoon and swam all afternoon.
Marcy was a quiet town where Steve had had a normal childhood and where people felt safe. But on a warm September evening in 1985, that sense of security was severely shaken, and Steve's life was changed forever.
Kimberly M. Simon, 16, whose body was found off a lonely dirt road yesterday, was strangled. Oneida County District Attorney Barry M. Donnelly said today.
At around 6 p.m. on September 18, 1985, Kim Simon left her home in Marcy on Route 49, also known as River Road, and began walking down Mohawk Street toward Whitesboro. She planned to meet a friend at the Whitesboro Junior High School, about 2 miles from her home, and then go for pizza. She never made it. When she didn't return home that evening, her parents notified police, who found her body the next day near the side of a dirt road off Mohawk Street.
The day after the homicide.
Edward Kaminsky is a Utica attorney, the first lawyer hired to represent Steve.
They had a roadblock at Kavanaugh Road and River Road.
Kavanaugh Road becomes Mohawk Street on the south side of its intersection with Route 49 or River Road.
And Steve lived on Kavanaugh Road, above where the, roadblock area. He came through the roadblock initially. They asked him if he knew anything. He said, I didn't see anything. I know nothing. Fine.
They were looking for her. They were showing pictures on the corner of 49 and Mohawk Street. They asked me if I seen this girl, Cam. I said, no.
He went through the roadblock, cooperated with the police, went through the roadblock another time, cooperated with the police.
Although current Oneida County District Attorney Scott McNamara was not involved in Steve's prosecution, he's familiar with the details of the case.
The third time that he had to go through the roadblock, because he lived on the road, he went around the roadblock.
Steve had simply decided to stop for a six-pack of beer. He had just passed the beverage store, so he turned around by cutting through the parking lot of a convenience store on the other side of the street.
And there was an unmarked cop car on a payphone there. And I just cut through the parking lot, not thinking nothing of it.
He just avoided it, set off all kinds of alarms. Oh, my God, where's this guy trying to avoid the roadblock?
When he did that, the police noticed it. They put a lot of weight on that. I don't know if I would, but they did. He then became a person of interest, so to say, because of that. They started interviewing him.
And ever since that day, it just kept going. I was 19 years old at the time. 3 days after the murder, they called me up and asked me to come over. I said, no problem. First hour, they were all nice, you know. Then after that, they verbally harassed me for hours, asked me where I was on this night. Two officers came in, looked me in the eye, and slammed their hand on the desk and said, you did this. I would argue right back with them, you know, and they fingerprinted me. They took pictures of me.
Then I came home that evening, and Steve wasn't home, and it was kind of strange. He hadn't called in, and he hadn't come home for dinner, and I was getting kind of nervous. And, of course, it was the day before cell phones.
I asked for phone calls. I used to call my mom. I was gone all day. He said I never asked for one.
I mean, what 19-year-old kid, when he's getting questioned for a murder, is not going to call his family? He asked for his family lawyer. They wouldn't let him make a phone call all day long. They had him like there for 12 hours interrogation, never let him call anybody.
Then they took me to Oneida, the trooper's barracks. I took a polygraph test, and then I went home.
And it was like 11 o'clock at night, and he came knocking on our bedroom door, and he goes, Mom, you got to get up. I got a problem, and I opened up the door, and I said, what's the matter? And he says, I've been at the sheriff's department all day. I go, for what? He said, they're questioning me for Kimberly Simon's murder.
The results of the polygraph test were inconclusive, but Steve had an alibi.
I was home until about 5:30, and then I was stopping at Nimes gas station, got gas, went to Riverside Bowling Alley the whole night.
My family owned it, so I was bartending.
Ed Lewandrowski.
So he would always come in after his job. He's a construction worker. We'd all meet down there. That was the gathering spot.
He told them that he had been in the area. He did not see Kimberly. He had stopped and got $5 worth of gas and then drove to the bowling alley.
Current Oneida County District Attorney Scott McNamara.
They went, they interviewed the gas station attendant, who was a young kid, who told the police that, yes, he knew Steve. He remembered pumping the $5 of gas and that Steve drove to the bowling alley. And everything seems to be good at that point for Steve, I would say.
But in 1985, murders were fairly uncommon in Oneida County, especially in the idyllic town of Marcy.
This is a horrific crime. You know, it's one of those crimes that it gets the whole community upset, scared. I mean, you're talking about a 16-year-old that's basically snatched off the road, raped, sodomized, and murdered. It's every parent's worst nightmare.
Attorney Edward Kaminsky.
At the time, this was big news. It was headlines in the paper every single day. Every single day it was in the paper. Everybody was clamoring for a result. We want to find the killer.
As the investigation continued, there was a Utica police officer, off-duty Utica police officer, who came forward and said that he was on Mohawk Street the night that this happened, and he remembered seeing something that he thought was suspicious. He told them that he drove by, he saw a male that would match the description of Steve, and that he was next to a pickup truck. He, interestingly enough, was shown a photographic array and did not pick Steve out at the initial stage.
Nonetheless, investigators continued to focus on Steve.
And they used to follow me around, made my life miserable, talked to a few of my friends, hassled my ex-girlfriend.
They constantly watched him. They used to watch my house, sit on top of the hill. They used to follow him down to his girlfriend, call his girlfriend's parents, you know, tell him your daughter's going to be the next one they find in the field dead, and just constantly harassed us, making our life miserable, especially Steve's.
They also did, interestingly, they did what there was a truck lineup, but Steven's truck was the only one that looked like Steven's truck, and that was kind of an interesting thing.
And the officer said, yep, that's the red pickup truck I saw. During the matter, Judge Buckley was the presiding judge in the matter. Now he's in the Appellate Division in New York City. And I showed him a cartoon of a man, a rabbit, and a rock, and with a victim pointing at the man saying, that's the man, Your Honor. I mean, this is what it was.
Now the investigation continues for, I think, like 3 years. Ultimately, that police officer now picks out Stephen Barnes out of a photo array. What changed in those 3 years, or what took place when he was being shown that photo array, or all of that surrounding stuff, I have no idea. I don't know what all of a sudden made him be able to pick him out where he couldn't pick him out initially.
They arrested me on March 25th, 1988. And they come knocking at my front door, and the officer said, you remember us? And I said, yeah, how could I forget you? And they said, a few people come forward and pointed the finger at you, and you're under arrest.
On March 25th, 1988, I walked in the door, and my younger son, Sean, was sitting there, and he said to me, Mom, they came and picked up Steve. I go, who picked him up? I'm thinking one of his friends, you know. So they came and arrested him for Kimberly Simon's murder.
I was in shock. I was yelling at the officers, screaming. I was with my brother and my girlfriend at the time. They were all freaking out.
I didn't want to live. I was devastated. I mean, I was in shock. I couldn't believe it. You know, my God, how could they do this, you know? I was like stunned, absolutely stunned.
I'm in the cop car and I go, I can't even believe this is happening.
And it was the beginning of our 24-year nightmare.
The first witness of the day was Oneida County Sheriff's Department Lieutenant Charles Scheiderick.
They had Steve out on bail for a year. 14 months, actually. They arrested him in March, and it didn't go to trial till May of 89.
The case was prosecuted by Oneida County Assistant District Attorney William Kernan, who has since passed away. Steve's mother, Sylvia, had replaced Edward Kaminsky with a more experienced lawyer.
We hired the best attorney we could, Salvatore Capasalatro.
Capasalatro is also now deceased.
He said, we will represent your son. He hasn't done anything. So we were very confident.
At the time, my first impression was of his mother.
Lori Duffy Foster covered the trial for the Syracuse Post-Standard.
I guess I would describe her as if she was a rock. She was just very emotionally in charge of herself, or trying to be. I was very skeptical, and I couldn't quite form an impression from that. I had decided then that either she knew he was guilty, but he was her son, and she needed to stay strong for him and she loved him, or she knew he was innocent and knew she had to keep herself together.
Steve's family and friends were confident of his innocence.
He could have never have done something like that. Never.
Steve's sister, Lisa Pulowski.
He was not good at lying. You can tell when he does. You can't look somebody in the eyes. Nope.
Ed Lewandrowski.
It was ridiculous, you know, because I saw him that evening. I saw him supposedly right after the crime was committed, according to their timeline. And to tell me that somebody I've known since first grade just went out and brutally raped and killed and then come and meet me and, hey, what's up, and talk about our day like any other day is just ridiculous, you know. So I'm getting goosebumps thinking about it, going back in time like that. But he was right there at Riverside Lanes. What's up, Steve? Nothing, you know. So I knew he didn't do it. I knew he didn't do it from day one.
The timeline was key. Kim Simon left her house at around 6 p.m. and began walking down Mohawk Street. Steve said he wasn't on Mohawk Street at all that day, but that he left his house between 5:30 and 6, stopped for gas, and drove to the bowling alley on Route 49. During the initial investigation, a gas station employee corroborated Steve's story. But on the stand, he suddenly remembered things differently.
The gas station attendant changed the story.
Current Oneida County District Attorney Scott McNamara.
And said that Stephen did not drive to the bowling alley, that he in fact, turned down Mohawk Street right after Kimberly walked down the street.
I thought people were my friends. They made stuff up. The cops kind of strong-arm him, say this. He was a young kid, 16, 17.
And ultimately, I think that was a very, very harmful thing to Steve, because if that kid had continued to say, hey, listen, I saw Steve Barnes and he drove to the bowling alley. Stephen Barnes' alibi was at the bowling alley. Everybody in the bowling alley said Stephen Barnes was in the bowling alley.
If those testimonies of his alibi were correct.
Former Syracuse Post-Standard reporter Lori Duffy Foster.
Then he would have had to kill Kimberly Simons and get back to Riverside Lanes in about 10 minutes. It was just unbelievable.
Other witnesses gave conflicting testimony. Some said they saw Kim on Mohawk Street and even said that they saw her talking to Steve in his truck. Others said they saw Kim and a man in a truck, but that it wasn't Steve and it wasn't Steve's truck.
And we were very confident. I mean, every day we come down the elevator and our defense attorney used to say, nobody heard us today. You know, even the prosecution witnesses really were helping Steve. You know, they'd say that wasn't his truck. And this wasn't when I seen him, and this wasn't the time and all.
Then there was the testimony of off-duty Utica police officer Philip Arcuri.
Officer Arcuri testified that as he drove down Mohawk Street, he saw a maroon pickup truck parked by the side of the road facing south.
The left front wheel. It was illegal, to my opinion.
Illegal.
It was like a ball tire.
The part that I found somewhat hard to believe afterwards, as you look at it, was he said that for like 2 minutes he had an opportunity to look at Steve, recognize a lot of stuff about Steve's truck, including that it had a bald front tire. Since that time, we've actually went and drove that road, and giving him the benefit of all doubts, it probably was a 6 to 10 second encounter to notice all these things.
Arcuri said he saw a young man walking near the truck, a man he identified as the defendant.
In 1985, Arcuri had not been able to pick Steve out of a lineup.
3.5 years later, he's picking me out and my truck. He said his memory was better after 3.5 years.
He couldn't see a thing without his glasses, and he claims to see Stephen Barnes while he's going 25 miles an hour past the pickup truck, and he doesn't know the guy. There's no way.
For the third day, testimony centered around lab results.
The prosecution claimed to have scientific evidence that would prove Kim Simon was in Steve's truck. For example, investigators had found in the vehicle two hairs that were similar to Kim's hair.
The first witness of the day was Anthony Orlowski, a senior lab technician with the New York State Crime Lab in Albany. Capasoletro asked Orlowski to read a section of a report prepared by another lab analyst who had examined samples taken from Stephen Barnes' pickup truck.
Nothing was discovered which would show an association between the vehicle and deceased. Go ahead. Because control hair was not submitted from the owner of the vehicle, no comparison of hair was conducted.
Thank you.
That hair means nothing to me. It was consistent with Kimberly's hair. Well, so was Steve's sister's hair.
The police had also found a denim imprint on the side of Steve's truck.
That imprint apparently matched or was very similar to the jeans that Kimberly was wearing. They put a lot of weight into that. I don't today because how many jeans are out there that could match that?
There had also been mud on Steve's truck, which the prosecution claimed was consistent with soil samples taken from the spot where Kim's body was found.
And they went and took the dirt like 2.5 years later from the crime scene.
A couple of other pieces of forensic evidence seemed to contradict the prosecution's arguments. First, tire track impressions taken from the scene did not match the tires on Steve's truck. And second, experts testified that semen found on Kim's underwear could not be conclusively matched with Steve's blood type. But the prosecution did have one more piece of seemingly incriminating evidence.
I had a jailhouse informant when I was in the county. He said I told him I did this, and I never spoke to the guy, but he got a time cut.
A question was asked Mr. Barnes about a girl, and Mr. Barnes says, "Who do you mean, the girl I killed? I mean the one I'm accused of killing." Freudian slip?
I didn't even know who he was, but he said I spoke to him.
The evidence was just, it was almost comical.
Former Syracuse Post-Standard reporter Lori Duffy Foster.
If there had not been lives involved here, life and death, it would have been comical.
Is this the type of evidence you would want your husband, your brother, your son convicted of?
They had no evidence on him.
Steve's sister, Lisa Pulaski.
There was nothing, and I knew he didn't do it, never in a million years.
Even the prosecutor himself admitted that it was all circumstantial evidence. The scientific evidence was unreliable.
In the beginning, I said this case was built around circumstantial evidence.
I just thought this is going to be a formality. Okay, we're going to go through all this, and very difficult to, you know, sit there and listen to them give all this testimony. And
each piece of this circumstantial evidence is a piece of that puzzle that we're going to put together.
I'm not entirely convinced that the prosecutor was certain of his case. On the closing day, when the jury went into deliberations, he had said that he was hopeful that the jury would put the pieces together and find him guilty. And then he said, and this is how I quote him in the story, if Barnes is found innocent, then we're back to square one. He didn't say if Barnes is found innocent, then a murderer runs free or anything like that. He said, then we're back to square one. And it just seems to me that William Kernan was wavering, that he was convincing himself as well as the jury.
It was said to be a long, tense day. The parents of the victim held hands. The mother of the man accused of killing her carried rosary beads.
Of course, I was there on the day that the jury went out and was deliberating, and the next day when the verdict came back, I was there.
Steve's friend, Ed Lewandrowski.
I didn't go that day. I couldn't.
I said, they can't convict me of this, you know. On June 2nd, they did.
The jury came in. The clerk asked what their verdict was on the first count, one of rape.
I'm charged with rape in the first degree.
Guilty.
I thought for sure I was going to be not guilty. When they said guilty, I was in a state of shock.
One by one, the jury foreman read the verdicts. Guilty of rape, sodomy, and murder. The Barnes family reacted with anger and grief.
I immediately started crying and looked at my brother and...
The defendant at first looked ahead at the desk in front of him, then dropped his head.
I melted right there. There's a famous picture of me with my head down. I just started crying and I just went into like shock. I was like, I can't even believe this is happening to me, you know?
I threw up. I got physically sick. I couldn't believe it. The kid, they had no evidence. I just didn't understand what they convicted him on.
I was shocked. I was very much shocked, as was, I think, much of the courtroom. I remember he cried, but I remember his mother did not. I mean, you could look at her and see she was on the verge, and you could see it was a huge battle for her.
When they announced the verdict, I could not believe it. I just couldn't believe it.
But it was almost like she said to herself, I can't afford to break down. I need to just accept this and move on to the next step. Publicly, she was just a rock.
I never took a drop of food or water or anything for 7 days. I didn't even want to live. I thought, you know, this can't be happening.
The only thing I can think of is that they believe the testimony of what I believe to be the lies of the Utica cop, and they believed him. Cops aren't supposed to lie.
I know the trial strategy of the defense lawyer was that the prosecution had approved their case. They had proved that Steve was guilty, and Steve did not prove that he was not guilty. So Steve didn't take the stand.
I think a big part of it, though, for the jury was the fact that Stephen Barnes did not testify. That never looks good to a jury. So if they were unsure one way or the other, that might have thrown them in the direction of guilty.
This was a Friday afternoon, and they had been deliberating Thursday and then all day Friday. And
if you look at how long the jury deliberated, they deliberated 10 hours one day and 6 hours the next. So they clearly were torn as well. If they were certain of his guilt, they would have come back a lot faster than that. But I personally don't even know how the jury could have deliberated that long.
My opinion, they didn't want to be sequestered for the weekend. They wanted to go home to their families.
On August 31st, 1989, Steve was given the maximum sentences allowable for the crimes. 8 1/3 to 25 years for the rape and sodomy charges, and 25 years to life on each of 3 counts of murder.
I'm innocent of all charges. I didn't commit these charges.
Salvador Capisalatro.
I meant what I said. I have an undying belief that my client is innocent.
Unfortunately for Steve, today, he would have never got convicted because the DNA isn't his DNA, and we would have known that, and it would have never been tried.
I never told anybody in prison good morning, or never a good morning in there. It's just the way it is. I was in Wendy out near Buffalo, Green Haven, down near the city. With some Poughkeepsie. I was in Eastern, Southport, out near Elmira. I was in Auburn for a little bit. Passed through Sing Sing. About it.
Steve Barnes is a tall, brawny man with light brown hair. He's quick to smile, with an easygoing manner, and a perpetual glint in his bluish-gray eyes. Steve looks much younger than a man in his mid-40s, despite the hardships he's endured.
I just seen guys get stabbed all the time. I seen guys get hot oil thrown on them, their skin melted off. Seen guys get burned up in their cell. I was in a mess hall. There was a riot. They dropped tear gas.
It's a maximum security prison, so there's some scary people in there.
Steve's friend, Ed Lewandrowski.
It's a scary place, and it made me feel awful that, you know, that he had to spend day after day, week after week, year after year in a place like that for a crime he didn't commit. You know, it was just awful. Scary.
I had to stab somebody. I got stabbed. That's part of the lifestyle you're forced to live. You got to fight for yourself, stand up for yourself, and people respect you. It's just all gang stuff, so you got to endure a lot of violence through the years, you know?
He expressed to me one time that, you know, he was going to be going out in the yard, and he may not be coming back. Something bad was going to happen.
Violence. Prisons, there's something always happening every minute. You walk out into the yard, there's 800-900 guys, and they're all in their little cliques and gangs, and something's always popping off, you know? It's a type of place.
And, you know, it's being naive and being a person on the outside. You can't imagine what's going to happen. I mean, you see things on TV. There's prison riots and so forth. But to actually be involved in one, I couldn't. I have no idea what that would be like.
The strong survive and the weak, you don't make it. You know, you just got to be tough, strong-minded, and have a strong heart. And
he was reserved, especially in the very beginning. He was very, very scared. I mean, as well as we were.
Steve's sister, Lisa Pulaski.
You know, he was only, 22, 23?